our series through the book of Genesis. We're in chapter 37. This is actually message number 38 in this series entitled A Tale of Two Coats. Genesis chapter 37, and we'll be looking at this whole chapter this evening, but we'll begin with reading verse 1. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. So chapter 36 that we looked at last time wraps up the account of Isaac and Esau and really Jacob for the most part. The chapter gives a long list of descendants. It focuses on Esau's family, then expands more to the nation of Edom that came from Esau. And chapter 36 serves to highlight some fulfilled promises, particularly the promises of many nations and kings from Abraham. And the chapter also contributes to the overarching story of the Pentateuch that looks for the seed of the woman and the king of Israel. So now as we come to chapter 37, this chapter begins the last major section in the book of Genesis. So chapter 37 through chapter 50, the end of the book, all focus on Joseph. And sometimes people will refer to it as the story of Joseph in the last part of this book. Now, Jacob lives until almost the very end of the book of Genesis, but Joseph is certainly the primary character that we focus on as we go through this account. And the secondary character in this account would actually be his brother Judah, as both of them are intertwined throughout the rest of this book. And the other brothers are more minor characters. And of course, Jacob is still there and comes in and out of the story at different points. And so this section is actually around about 25% of the book of Genesis. So it's a good chunk of the book. And it is a continuous story to the end. In other words, what we start here in Genesis 37 is really going to go all the way through chapter 50. It's told in a series of connected episodes, but it is all connected together with one thing leading to the next and so on. Now, chapter 37 in particular sets up this section of Genesis, and it sets up this story of Joseph with conflict. And that should be no surprise to us, because we've noticed how, as we have gone through the book of Genesis, that conflict is thematic. There's continually conflict, and it comes in various ways in these accounts. So Jacob contributes to sibling jealousy in his sons by showing preferential treatment to Joseph. Joseph further drives the conflict by telling two dreams that he had. And the chapter ends with Joseph sold into slavery, Jacob mourning his death and his brothers being guilty. So the story starts out with the fancy coat that Jacob gives to Joseph, and it ends with that coat covered in blood and another coat torn in grief. So we're going to look at this chapter, and it really divides into two parts. Verses 1 to 11 that really get everything set up and going and deal with Joseph and his dreams. And verses 12 to 36, which show us the sibling rivalry between Joseph and his brothers turning deadly. So we're going to start with verses 1 to 11 in this first part, Joseph and his dreams. And we'll begin here with verses 1 to 4. And Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father their evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. And when his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. So the opening verse of this chapter actually corresponds to the end of chapter 36 and those verses about Esau. And the point is made that Esau is dwelling in his inheritance, which is Seir, and Jacob is dwelling in his inheritance, that is the land of his fathers, even though he's dwelling there as a stranger. He makes note of that his father was a stranger in the land of Canaan. He was a foreigner. He was a sojourner in the land of Canaan, pointing out the fact that neither Abraham nor Isaac nor Jacob ever yet possessed the land that had been promised to them, but were sort of foreigners traveling about, pilgrims in that land. So Moses sets up this account, and he does it by stating certain facts. And that's what we really get in these first four verses. We just sort of get the setting. So we get the circumstance of what is about to happen. So we're told that Joseph was young. So he was 17 years old at the time that this account begins. He was working with his brothers, which means that he most likely was being young, out in the field with the flocks with his brothers, means that he was sort of like an apprentice. He's learning the work, and he's being trained in the work and so on. And it's mentioned that he was with the sons of Bilhah and with Zilpah, which these would be the ones he was closest to in age. And that would be Dan and Naphtali and Gad and Asher that he would have been with in the field. Now, we're told that Joseph gave an evil report to Jacob, their father, concerning his four brothers. All right, so we aren't given any details of the circumstances. We don't know what this report contained. We don't know what that was about. But when we look at the word that is used for evil report, it's a word that doesn't occur real frequently in the Old Testament. But when it does, it's generally negative, and sometimes it's even translated slander. And so it, at the very least, it points to what might amount to gossiping or what's referred to as talebearing in the Bible. And now we have no reason to believe that Joseph lied in the sense that he, made up some sort of accusation against his brothers. We certainly have no reason to believe that that would be the case. At the very least, though, I believe that we get a picture of Joseph at the start. He's a young man, and we see perhaps at least some immaturity with Joseph, perhaps a lack of wisdom, and that's consistent as the account unfolds. Now, that certainly is not the Joseph that we find at the end of the account, but that is how that he starts out this way. Jacob, we're told, loved Joseph more than all of his children. He preferred him. He chose him first above all of his children. Now, one of the things that Moses is indicating to us here is likely that Jacob was choosing to give Joseph the rights of the firstborn over that of Reuben. And we know that a few chapters back, we saw how that Reuben sinned against his father, Jacob. And we know later that Reuben will forfeit those rights when the blessings are given out in Genesis chapter 49. And so it's probably an indication here that Jacob has chosen Joseph for these special rights of the firstborn over Reuben. And so as a result, we're told that he gave him this coat. This coat is described here as a coat of many colors. Now, the word that is used here doesn't clearly indicate that it was a multicolored coat. It certainly could mean that, but it doesn't clearly mean that. The word describes a robe or an outer cloak that extends to the wrists and the ankles. All right, so it's something that is sometimes described as wide. So it's ornamental. You might call it a dress or a dress robe or a decorated robe in that sense. And it was the sort of a garment that a king would wear. It was a sort of garment that someone of royalty might wear, or at the very least, someone that was extremely wealthy and powerful might be dressed in. Now, the fact that it was decorative, it probably certainly did include different colors. But, if I remember correctly, I think the flannel graph in Sunday school, had sort of this rainbow colored number on. And we don't really know what this looked like. Probably not the rainbow colored thing of the flannel graph, but nevertheless, it was ornamental. It was decorative. Probably did involve different colors, but it was sort of long sleeved and wide sleeved and would have extended down to his feet. So it would have spoken of position and significance. And this is the coat that Jacob gives to his son, which again, he's 17 years old and has 10 older brothers than him, but yet he's the one that receives this. Now, the last fact of the state of things that we're told in verse number 4 was that his brothers hated him. And they hated him because Jacob loved him more. And Jacob's actions toward Joseph were not, you might say, fair and consistent toward all of his children, but rather he showed a lot of preference to Jacob. And his brothers hated him to the point that they could not even speak to him. They didn't even want to talk to him. And I'm sure we've all perhaps experienced that at a time or another, whether we were so angry with someone that we just didn't really want to talk to them, or maybe they were so angry with us they didn't want to talk to us. We've certainly experienced that, but that was the state of things with his brothers. They didn't even want to talk to Joseph. They hated him so much, and this was, of course, fueled by their father's preferential treatment of Joseph above them. So now that's the setup, and we start moving into this account. So let's look at verses 5 to 11. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said unto them, Hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaf stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, Shalt thou indeed reign over us? Or shalt thou indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. And he dreamed yet another dream, and told it his brethren, and said, Behold, I have dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, What is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? And his brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. So now we're told that Joseph had a pair of dreams. And these are the fifth and the sixth dreams that are recorded in Genesis. Remember how we have talked about how almost half of all the dreams that are recorded in the Bible are in the book of Genesis. There's some 21 dreams in all of the Bible, most of those in the Old Testament, and most of those are in the book of Genesis, 10 of them, in fact. And so these are dreams number 5 and 6 in the book of Genesis. And so 6 out of the 10 dreams that are in the book of Genesis are in this section, in chapters 37 to 50. And all 6 of those that are in this section, they all involve Joseph in some way. He either had the dream, which was the case of the two here, or he interpreted the dreams, which is the case of the 4 remaining in this section. Now, Joseph's dreams, they do differ from the dreams we've encountered so far in the book of Genesis. So these dreams involved no voices. There's no speaking that there's any record of. There's no commands that were given to Joseph. There was no information or revelation that was given to Joseph in terms of any sort of a voice. So what these dreams were, these dreams were symbolic scenes. And though they were symbolic scenes, they didn't require interpretation for his brothers to understand what they meant. It was very clear. So he didn't see something actual taking place. He saw a representation of something that will take place in the future. And that was the same with both of the dreams. So in the first dream, Joseph sees a scene where he and his brothers are working in the field and they are gathering and binding together these sheaves of grain. And so Joseph's sheaf that he has bound up, it stands upright in the field. And his other his brother's sheaves around it bow down to his sheaf. Now, of course, his brothers immediately responded, assuming that the dream meant that Joseph would reign over his brothers. Now, we talked about that word for reign in chapter 36, because that was the first time that that word appeared in the book of Genesis. And now we get it again here in reference to the elevation of Joseph over his brethren. And the result was, of this first dream, was that they hated him even more. They're just growing in their anger and hatred toward Joseph. Well, that's not enough. He has a second dream. And that second dream sort of expanded that symbolic vision, because now he has a dream where the sun, the moon, and 11 stars all bow down to him. And of course, he told that to his father as well as his brothers. And Jacob understood that dream to mean that Joseph would rule over his brothers and his father and mother. And by mention of mother, he probably is referring to Bilhah, who was Rachel's servant maid that Jacob took as a concubine. And she would have taken the place of Rachel concerning Joseph after Rachel's death. And so that's most likely what is meant there by that. And the result was his brothers were provoked to jealousy against Joseph. So they were angry with Joseph, they hated Joseph, and they were also envious of Joseph, and no doubt of the special treatment that he received from their father Jacob. Now, we're told that Jacob rebuked Joseph, but also that he wondered about these things. He wondered about these dreams, wondering about what they might mean and how they might come to be fulfilled. So what we see by the time we get to verse 11 in this chapter is now that the conflict has escalated and the hatred of the brothers for Joseph has escalated. And that drives us into the second part of the chapter where the sibling rivalry turns deadly. So let's begin here with verses 12 to 14. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said unto Joseph, do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said unto him, here am I. And he said to him, go, I pray thee, see whether it will be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. So Joseph's brothers had taken the flocks to Shechem. And of course, Shechem was the place where all of the men of the city were slain by Simeon and Levi, and all the women and children were carried away as captives. Essentially, they destroyed this city of Shechem. And so perhaps in Jacob's mind, this was a somewhat dangerous place for them to go. Maybe worrying that some of the neighboring nations would fall on them or something. But either way, we're not told exactly what his motivation was. But he calls Joseph, and he wants to send him to Shechem to go and check on his brothers and the flocks. And this would have been about 50 miles away from Hebron. And so Joseph, he sets out and he goes to Shechem, we're told. Look at verses 15 to 17. And a certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, they are departed hence. For I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. So Joseph had made it to Shechem, which would have taken a few days at least for him to make the trip between Hebron and Shechem. But he had made it to Shechem, and we're told that he was wandering in the field. Now, we don't know for how long. We don't know exactly how long it took him to get there. We don't know how long that he may have been looking around and trying to figure out where his brothers were and what had happened to them. We don't know. But we are told that he was met by this unnamed man that found him and asked him what he was doing, to which Joseph just responded honestly that he was looking for his brothers. And the man happened to overhear the brothers. He knew who they were, and he heard them discuss their plans, and he knew that they were at Dothan, and that was about another 15 miles away from from there in Shechem. And so Joseph is essentially wandering around, not knowing where they are, not really knowing what to do. And this unnamed man appears that happens to know where the brothers went, and so he directs him there. And then Joseph goes to Dothan at the word of this man, and he does find his brothers. Now, beginning in verse 18, "And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. And they said one to another, Behold, this dreamer cometh. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him, and cast him into some pit, and we will say, Some evil beast hath devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands, and said, Let us not kill him. And Reuben said unto them, Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands, to deliver him to his father again." So Joseph has found his brothers at Dothan, and we're told that the brothers see Joseph coming a long way off. And, of course, we find out later that they take his coat from him, so they probably are able to clearly identify him from a distance because of this coat that he is wearing, and which probably irritated them all the more. So they quickly conspire to kill him, and they are mockingly referring to him as the dreamer. This dreamer comes, and they're talking of what will become of his dreams if he's dead in a pit. Now, Moses shows that they were motivated by their hatred, and particularly their hatred concerning his dreams. It seems that that was the point that just pushed them over the edge, and they keep making reference to it. But then we're told how that Reuben intervened, Reuben being the firstborn of the sons, and he talked them into not killing him, but just throwing him into a pit. And then Moses gives us some further insight that his plan was to secretly rescue Joseph and to bring him back to Jacob. Now, we're not told as far as anything further as far as his motivation was concerned, but it seems at least possible that maybe he hoped to gain some favor back with Jacob by sparing his favorite son and delivering him back into his hands. Let's look at verses 23 to 28 now. "And it came to pass, when Joseph was coming to his brethren, that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat bread, and they lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead, and their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother in our flesh, and his brethren were content. Then there passed by Midianites merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit, and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt." So when Joseph got to them, we're told that they took him, they stripped off his coat, and they threw him into this pit, which is described as being a dry cistern. It didn't have any water in it. And so obviously we can see that they had accepted Reuben's plan and his intervention, at least so far. And then we read about how that they sit down to eat bread, and they see this group of traveling merchants that are coming. And this sparks an idea for Judah. And he starts reasoning with his brothers that, well, just leaving him in a pit or even just killing him wouldn't really provide any profit for them. And they could always sell him to the merchants and at least make some money out of the deal. And, of course, the brothers, they come to agree to this. I mean, and I guess after their initial plan, it feels like maybe this is merciful. So they agree to this. And they pull Joseph out, and they sell him to these Ishmaelites. And then we get the conclusion of this chapter, verses 29 to 36. "And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes. And he returned unto his brethren and said, The child is not, and I, whither shall I go? And they took Joseph's coat and killed a kid of the goats and dipped the coat in the blood. And they sent the coat of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "This have we found. Know now whether it be thy son's coat or no." And he knew it and said, "It is my son's coat. An evil beast hath devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. And the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and a captain of the guard. So we're told how that Reuben returns to the pit. And his, again, his plan was to come and rescue Joseph secretly. And he returns to the pit, but Joseph's not there. He's not in the pit. And so he went to his brothers, and they took his coat, they killed this goat and put its blood on the coat and sent it to Jacob. And of course, this is one of those ironic parallels that we have noted a number of parallels in different ways in these accounts. And so Jacob, who had once deceived his own father by the use of goat skins, is now deceived himself by the clothes of another and the blood of a goat. And he believes that Joseph is dead. And so we're told of how he mourns greatly. He rips his own coat, his own cloak, at the news, puts on sackcloth and mourns for many days at what he believes to be the death of his most beloved son, Joseph. And then the account, of course, ends noting that Joseph was taken to Egypt and sold to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officers. And again, the account is going to continue on as we proceed, though there is another event in chapter 38 before we get back to Egypt. So when we're looking at chapter 37, you realize as you look through this chapter that the chapter turns on the limits of human knowledge and the providence of God. So there's this contrast that's continually playing throughout this chapter. So if you think about Joseph, Joseph is presented to us at least being what we might call naive as a young man. And he unintentionally provokes his brothers. So we're given all this insight into motivations that all these different ones had in their actions. And so we're not told that Joseph was trying to antagonize his brothers in any way. And it seems like he was somewhat naive and being young, and he was unintentionally provoking them with the things that he said. Now, when Joseph went to Shechem to find his brothers, he didn't know where they went. In other words, he had reached the limit of his human knowledge. He didn't know where they were. He didn't know how to find them. And he didn't also know that this particular delay that had taken him however much time that it took him, and this extra journey that he had not foreseen to go to Dothan, all of these things together would actually put him there in Dothan in the presence of his brothers at just the right time for these traveling merchants to pass through and him to be sold to them. So in a sense, the limits of his knowledge and such, and he's trying to do what his father sent him to do, and nevertheless, he's put himself right in the right, the place at that particular time for those events to happen. If you think about the brothers in particular, they were escalating their hatred for Joseph, and that led them to want to kill him, but in the end to sell him into slavery. And we're told that they wanted to kill him because they wanted to prevent his dreams from coming true, on the one hand. Behold, this dreamer comes, and let's see what becomes of his dreams, you know, when he's dead in a pit. They didn't want his dreams to come true. They're taking actions that they believe will cause these dreams to not come true, to not be realized. And what they didn't know is that they're actually moving Joseph along into the very condition in which his dreams will come true. And they did not know that. Reuben was the oldest brother, and he wanted to rescue Joseph secretly, perhaps gaining favor with Jacob by returning him. And he didn't know that his brothers had sold him. He wasn't there for that part of the negotiation. Well, then think about Jacob. Jacob wanted Joseph to have the rights of the firstborn and didn't know that promoting him would lead to his death, or at least what you might say his presumed death, because he didn't actually die. So what we read in this chapter is how that everyone was acting from their own motives. They were acting from their own plans and their own thoughts and their own reasons that they could put together. And everyone was acting in whatever way to bring about whatever the result or the outcome was that they desired. They had their own motives, but what they didn't know is what the results would be. So we're brought to see the limits of human knowledge. Again, especially like with his brothers. They wanted to silence Joseph. They wanted to ensure that his dreams would not come true, but they're actually doing the very things that are going to lead to those dreams coming true. And in fact, them bowing down to him some 22 years after this. So that's the limits of human knowledge, and we can see it in every aspect of every character in this chapter. They're all limited by that. So then what about God's providence? And this is just a tremendous chapter. Of course, this whole section of Genesis is just a tremendous part of the Bible that teaches us aspects of God's providence. Now, the dreams here that Joseph has, and again, he's not given any words. He's not commanded to do anything or commanded to not do anything. He's not given anything like that. He's just simply, he sees these scenes in his dream. And he, as well as all of his family, can figure out that these symbolic scenes are indicating that in some way his family is going to come to bow down to him. And that obviously is a reference to, that's a reference to submission. It's an authority reference. It's not saying they're going to worship him or anything like that. So these dreams, as do the dreams that come later in this section of Genesis, they all serve to remind that God is present and God is at work in all events to bring about his own purpose. In other words, there is a sovereign God who is orchestrating these events. And little insights like these dreams of Joseph's that intrude into Joseph's life and then escalate the hatred and the desire for violence against him, lead to him ultimately being sold into slavery and ending up in Egypt, where obviously we know that it is God's purpose that the nation of Israel is going to end up there. All of these things just serve as a reminder that there is a master designer at work who is orchestrating these events. And even though men are motivated by their own motivations, and that's clear in this chapter, everyone here is acting in their own motivations. Even if you just look at Joseph, for instance, who wants to just do what his father has told him to do. You go and find your brothers and you bring back a report to me of how they and the flocks are doing. And that's what Joseph is trying to do. He's trying to carry that out. Everyone in this account is acting from their own motivations, and they're doing the things that in their mind seems best to do for whatever reason, whether that's good or bad. But nevertheless, what the result, what the outcome is ultimately fulfilling God's will. Ultimately. So Israel, as they receive this word from Moses, and they're being taught their history, obviously they're being taught, and we know that this is, being familiar with the book, you know that this is leading into Israel going into Egypt and how they come to be there and ended up slaves themselves in Egypt. Israel is to understand that God was at work to honor his word and to honor his name. So he would bring them into the land and ultimately the nation from Jacob, will possess the promised land as a nation with the king from the tribe of Judah. In other words, God is going to fulfill His word. And even the very efforts of men to try to thwart that will not succeed. Now, Joseph was young, and he certainly lacked some wisdom. But Joseph is never portrayed to us as immoral. He's never portrayed to us in the Genesis account as someone dealing or acting deceitfully. We're never given that view of Joseph at all. He's always presented exemplary. And again, here he's young, he's naive, but he's not suggested that he's immoral. But despite that fact, Joseph suffers. And we see his suffering beginning in this chapter. So in other words, you would have to say, looking at all the characters in this chapter, Joseph seems to have the purest motives among everyone there. But yet, he suffers. Of course, the others suffer too in different ways. But if you think about Psalm 105 and verse 19, Psalm 105 talks about Joseph. And verse 19 says, until the time that this word came, the word of the Lord tried him. That's what's being said about Joseph in Psalm 105. Of course, a lot more is being said about Joseph in his story, but particularly referring to this event, is that he was being tried by the Lord in this event. So Joseph was being tested. He's presented to us as a man of faith. And yet he's being tested. Well, this reminds us of the book of James, in James chapter 1 and verses 2 to 8, where James wrote, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into diverse temptations or testing, knowing this, that the trying of your faith, the testing of your faith, worketh patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. The double-minded man is unstable in all of his ways." So James writes and says to rejoice when you are tested. When you face sufferings and trials, to rejoice that you are being tested. And we could look at other verses like that Paul wrote in the book of Romans that speak of the testing of faith. The book of Hebrews speaks of the chastening and the disciplining of the Lord that tests our faith and that it's not pleasant to endure. And so Joseph is one who is being tested. He's presented to us as a man of faith, but he came to understand that all of his suffering, and all of his trial, and all of this testing that he endured was according to the will of God to accomplish his good purpose. And of course, we'll see that when we get to chapter 50. In particular with Joseph. So God is always at work orchestrating events beyond our knowledge. That doesn't mean that we can see it. That doesn't mean that we can tell it. It doesn't mean that it's obvious to us or to others. But what faith does, faith trusts in the wisdom of God to do what is right. Even though we can't understand, we can't comprehend, and maybe there are others who, like Joseph's brothers, are even working from some evil motives to try to hurt us. But nevertheless, God is in control. God is at work. God is working these things together for good, as Paul said. And we may not have or comprehend those reasons why. So where does that leave us? Well, once again, it leaves us with the responsibility of faith. And the responsibility of faith is to obey the word that God has given us and trust in Him that He does.